Well, I don't like to ignore the circumstances, so let me just make one side comment on a very profound totalitarian ideal, which is not uncommon in parts of the West. It reached its peak in Nazism and Stalinism. It's the conviction that by criticizing the policies of a state, you're criticizing the people, the country, and the culture. Identifying state policy with the population, culture, and the society, that's the essence of totalitarianism. So for example, the concept of anti-Americanism, which one hears often, is drawn straight from Stalinism. Under Stalin, critics of the Soviet state were called anti-Soviet. Stalinists and their analogs described critics of the American government as anti-American, on the same assumption that the government has to be identified with the population, the country, and the culture. And the same is true of the identification of policies of the State of Israel with its society, people, and culture, so that criticism of those policies is interpreted as anti-Zionism or anti-Semitism, another straight totalitarian concept. In fact, those who have a good Jewish education will recognize the origins of this. It goes back to the Bible, the second book of Kings, where King Ahab, who was the epitome of evil in the Bible, calls the prophet Elijah to him and condemns the prophet Elijah as a hater of Israel. Ahab identifies himself with the culture, the population, and the society. So since Elijah is criticizing the evil king, he's a hater of Israel. It's unfortunate that the doctrines of King Ahab, Hitler, and Stalin carry over to the contemporary period, and it's worth thinking about. Well, I hope you won't mind if I change the topic slightly to a different triangle. The United States, Israel, Palestine, with only a few comments on Europe. Gaining some understanding of human affairs is not an easy task. In some respects, it's harder than the sciences. Mother Nature does not provide you with answers on a silver platter, but at least she doesn't go out of her way to set up barriers to understanding. In human affairs, that's the norm. It's necessary to dismantle the barriers that are set up by doctrinal systems, propaganda, and all the devices that derive very naturally from concentration of power. Sometimes eminent features are kind enough to offer some assistance. For example, the professor of the science of government at Harvard University, Samuel Huntington, who explained the function of the Soviet threat. He said, "You may have to sell intervention or other military action in such a way as to create the misimpression that it is the Soviet Union that you're fighting." That's what the United States has been doing ever since the Truman Doctrine. That is correct, case by case, but such honesty is rare. As the Soviet threat began to lose its effectiveness, it became necessary to resort to other misimpressions to sell military action, but the basic observations remain true to this moment. This observation illustrates a more general truism. Professions of benign intent by leaders should be dismissed. They're universal, they're predictable. That includes the worst monsters, Hitler, Stalin, Suharto, Saddam, others. Hence, they carry no information. For example, the foreign minister of Iran recently declared that Iran is dedicated to the construction of democracy and in a sovereign Iraq. Perhaps that's taken seriously by state loyalists, but it's shrugged off as irrelevant by others. And the same is true when Bush and Blair and Rice and others make these same pronouncements. In fact, it's much clearer in their case, for reasons that it takes some effort to ignore. They are sometimes expressed, for example, by the prominent Middle East specialist Augustus Richard Norton, who writes that as fantasies about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction were unmasked, all of that quickly disappeared into the memory hole, while the media and intellectual commentary jumped on the democratization bandwagon. At the liberal intellectual extreme, they hailed the president's messianic vision, as it was called, which proved that the invasion was the most noble war in history. There were critics. The critics agreed that it was noble and generous, but perhaps it's beyond our means. The beneficiaries of our nobility are too backward, and so on. It's very hard to find an exception in media and commentary. Now, there is some evidence to support the near universal conviction. The evidence is that the President, Prime Minister Blair, and other worthies had issued the declaration, so therefore it must be true. As in sufficiently disciplined circles in Iran, I suppose, or when the dear leader issues pronouncements in North Korea. Well, let's allow ourselves to depart from the party line. If we do, we find that Western leaders, like others, constantly issue fervent appeals for democracy, but we also find that they play very much the role that Professor Huntington described. It's necessary to sell intervention by creating the misimpression that they're fighting for democracy. Let's nevertheless put that aside and turn to the examples that are being put forth to demonstrate that the messianic vision is now real for the first time. There are three examples now put forth, Lebanon, Iraq, and Israel-Palestine. Lebanon we can omit quickly. The events in Lebanon followed from the killing of Rafiq Hariri, and unless the CIA and British intelligence were responsible for the bombing, the U.S. and Britain played no role in the democratic upsurge in Lebanon. Actually, that is one of the conspiracy stories circulating in Beirut, though I don't believe it, though one can imagine why it might spread. Anyway, we can put Lebanon aside. Iraq is a more interesting case. For lack of time, I won't go into it, but briefly, there were elections in Iraq in January, and they were a great success. The main success is that the U.S. and Britain were compelled to allow them to take place. The occupying forces tried in every way possible to avoid elections, but they had to back down in the face of nonviolent resistance, for which Ayatollah Sistani was the symbol. This is a real triumph of nonviolent resistance. Of course, once the elections did take place, the occupiers took credit for them, but if you look at the record, that's not what happened. They tried to block them and had to back down, not from bombers, but from nonviolent resistance, which refused to accept the orders of the occupation authorities on political and economic matters. The question now is whether the United States and Britain can be compelled to accept the outcome of the elections. There's little doubt that people voted with the hope that it would end the occupation. U.S.-run polls show overwhelming support for withdrawal of the occupying forces. That was a leading plank of the victorious Shiite alliance. Even the U.S. candidate had to include it. Blair's response was immediate, loud and clear. The prospect of withdrawal is not contemplated. Washington made the same statement. U.S. military forces will remain whatever Iraqis want. The Wall Street Journal wrote that Washington is attempting to secure agreement on a vague promise to withdraw eventually. And there are other issues. Will U.S. pressure compel the elected officials to keep to the occupation-imposed legal structure to open the economy up to U.S. takeover? These are sure to be continuing struggles, and in this case, Europe can play a significant role, have a significant impact if it chooses. Let's turn to the third example, Israel-Palestine. The most important recent event was the truce signed by Sharon and Abbas, which is a step forward. It's better to have no killing than killing. But it was a tremendous victory for U.S.-Israeli rejectionism. The framework is entirely theirs. The only substantive element is that Palestinian resistance, even against the occupying army, must cease. There is not a single word about what has always been the core issue, the programs of U.S.-Israeli takeover of valuable land and resources in the West Bank, particularly water, which is critically important. The U.S.-Israel programs to take over the occupied territories have concentrated on their water resources. Israel now uses 80% of the West Bank aquifer. That leaves Palestinians among the most water-deprived people in the world. Also, U.S. and Israel are constructing huge infrastructure projects to cantonize the population. The term cantonize, incidentally, is the one that's used by the most respected Israeli analysts. The truce contains not one word about the separation wall, which is breaking up the West Bank, overruling the judgment of the World Court that it is illegal. That was passed with only one dissent, the U.S. Justice. But he dissented on technical grounds. He agreed with the basic conclusion that the settlements are all illegal, that the Geneva Conventions apply to the occupied territories, that the U.S. and Israel are carrying out grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, which are, in fact, war crimes. It's rather similar to Oslo in 1993. The PLO accepted the Clinton doctrine that UN resolutions are, as in the words of the Clinton administration, are obsolete and anachronistic. Therefore, settlement and infrastructure development continued without pause. In fact, the peak year was the year 2000, the last year of Clinton and Barack, and it's the same now. Settlement increased 6% last year, now reaches 450,000, including illegally occupied East Jerusalem, and recent announcements effectively incorporate large regions into Israel. The policies continue without any break. A few days ago, Israel announced 3,500 new homes between Ma'ale Adumim and Jerusalem. That's the continuation of a project that was designed by Rabin and Peres with the support of Clinton to split the West Bank into two parts, virtually separating the southern part of the West Bank from the central and northern regions. That also virtually cuts off the West Bank from Jerusalem, which is the center of Palestinian commercial, cultural, and educational life. The northern and central regions are virtually separated by a second salient, including the Israeli town of Ariel and others. That's another Rabin Sharon Clinton scheme, since extended by Sharon under the pretext of withdrawal from Gaza. After Yasser Arafat died, there were elections. The New York Times had a major story on the front page. The headline was, "Hoping Democracy Can Replace a Palestinian Icon." In fact, Arafat had been elected in a closely supervised democratic election, but the U.S. later turned against him, so that wasn't democracy. Abbas has been there before. In December 2002, the Bush administration formally reversed the long-standing U.S. official position on the critical matter of the status of Jerusalem. It declared the annexation legitimate, unilaterally reversing Security Council resolutions that the U.S. had supported since 1968, at least in words. That eliminates any residual possibility of a peaceful negotiated settlement if the vote is taken seriously. Bush also declared the arch-terrorist Sharon a man of peace during his further depredations in the territories and demanded that Arafat, who was no longer fulfilling his assigned role satisfactorily, must be replaced by a prime minister who will be expected to meet U.S.-Israeli demands. That was Mahmoud Abbas. Although, as the New York Times explained, unlike Mr. Arafat, Abbas does not have a popular following. That provides further illustration of the president's vision of democracy. When Bush announced the messianic vision to bring democracy to the Middle East, he endorsed the imprisonment of the one elected Arab leader in the Arab world in his compound in Ramallah by the man of peace. Go back to the front page New York Times story on the death of Arafat. The first paragraph reads, "The post-Arafat era will be the latest test of a quintessentially American article of faith, that elections provide legitimacy even to the frailest institutions." The last paragraph of the article on the continuation page reads as follows, "The paradox for Palestinians is rich, however. In the past, the Bush administration resisted new national elections among the Palestinians. The thought then was that elections would make Mr. Arafat look better and give him a fresher mandate and might help give credibility and authority to Hamas. So the quintessential American faith, then, is that elections are fine if they come out the way we like, just as in the past, along with what's called the paradoxical quality. Our deeds consistently conflict with our words. That's called inconsistency, although there's an easier way to describe it in simple language. Learn more about the quintessential American faith and the prospects for peace and democracy by looking at the reporting of the death of Arafat. There was, again, a front-page New York Times story. It opens by saying, "Arafat was both the symbol of the Palestinians' hope for a viable independent state and the prime obstacle to its realization. He was never able to reach the heights of President Anwar Sadat of Egypt, who won back the Sinai through a peace treaty in Israel because he was able to reach out to Israelis and address their fears and hopes, unlike Arafat. That reveals the joys of owning history. When we turn to the unacceptable facts, we find something different. In 1971, President Sadat of Egypt offered a full peace treaty to Israel in return for withdrawal from Egyptian territory, saying nothing about the Palestinians. Jordan did the same shortly after. Israel recognized it to be what it called a genuine peace offer, but decided not to accept it, preferring expansion to security. At that time, expansion was into the Sinai, where thousands of farmers were expelled into the desert to clear the area for the all-Jewish city of Yamit. The crucial question, as always, was what would the United States do? Well, the United States decided to back Israel's decision, to follow Henry Kissinger's policy of what he called stalemate, no negotiations, only force. Sadat warned that if the United States and Israel refused diplomacy, he would have to go to war. And he did in 1973. That proved to be a very close thing for Israel, and in fact for the world. It even led to a nuclear alert. Kissinger realized that Egypt could not simply be dismissed, and he turned to diplomacy. That led finally to the Camp David agreements of 1978-79, when the U.S. and Israel accepted Sadat's 1971 offer. That enters history as a triumph of American diplomacy. President Carter won the Nobel Peace Prize. In fact, it was a diplomatic catastrophe. The rejection of Sadat's 1971 offer led to war, suffering, and extreme danger. How was Arafat the prime obstacle to realization of a Palestinian state? Perhaps that was in 1976, when the United States vetoed a Security Council resolution calling for a two-state settlement on the international border with full guarantees for Israel's rights and security. And without running through the history, the record continues in the same way to the present. That settlement has been supported by almost the entire world, including a large majority of the American population. Large majority support what's called the Saudi plan, which was reiterated a few days ago by the Arab foreign ministers, a full peace, normalization of relations in return for withdrawal from the conquered territories. That was rejected by Israel and ignored, no response from the United States. This continues right through the 1990s after the Oslo Agreement, alongside of continuing U.S.-Israeli expansion into the territories. The U.S. and Israel refused even to consider the possibility of a Palestinian state. Finally, in the year 2003, Bush's handlers decided that it was time for him to receive his vision of a Palestinian state somewhere, maybe in the Saudi Arabian desert. Since then, it's a journalistic convention in Europe as well to dedicate ourselves to Bush's vision, that is, a pale shadow of the Palestinian state supported by virtually the entire world, including most Americans, for 30 years, but blocked by Washington, as it still is. The goals of the Israeli doves were explained in 1998 by Shlomo Ben-Ami, who was soon to become Barak's chief negotiator at Camp David. He wrote in Hebrew that the Oslo peace process was to lead to a permanent neo-colonial dependency for the Palestinians in the occupied territories with some form of local autonomy. Israeli settlement and integration of the territories proceeded steadily with full U.S. support, and as I mentioned, it reached its highest rate in the final year of Clinton's term and Barack's, the year 2000. The obituary for Arafat in the New York Times keeps entirely to the official history, which is flatly refuted by the actual history. It finally reaches Camp David 2000, provides the standard story. I'm quoting, Arafat walked away from a magnanimous Clinton-Barack offer of peace, later refused to join Barack in accepting Clinton's December 2000 parameters, thereby proving conclusively that he insists on violence, a depressing truth with which the peace-loving states, the U.S. and Israel, must somehow come to terms. Now, the actual history. The actual history is that Camp David proposals divided the West Bank into three virtually separated cantons, all of them virtually separated from Jerusalem. It could not possibly be accepted by any Palestinian leader. It was also opposed by Abbas, the current U.S. favorite. It was easy to determine this. It was only necessary to look at a map. But that turned out to be impossible, because although maps were readily available from the U.S. sources, they were published nowhere. Real discipline. A few months after the collapse of Camp David, Clinton presented his parameters, which were vague, but went further, much further, toward a political settlement, thereby undermining the official story about the magnanimous offer, which Clinton conceded to have been unacceptable. What was the reaction to the parameters? Well, Clinton gave his own version. What he said is, both Prime Minister Barack and Chairman Arafat have now accepted these parameters as the basis for further effort. Both have expressed some reservations. Again, that completely undermines the official story repeated in the New York Times. After that, high-level Israeli and Palestinian negotiators proceeded to take the Clinton parameters as the basis for further efforts, and they addressed their reservations at meetings in Taba through January. And they reached a tentative agreement. Problems remained, but the Taba agreements went much farther towards a possible settlement than anything that had preceded, again completely undermining the official story about the magnanimous offer and Arafat's refusal. The negotiations were called off by Barack, Israeli Prime Minister, so the possible outcome is unknown. The European Union had an envoy, Miguel Moratinos. He presented a detailed report, which was accepted as accurate by both sides and prominently reported in Israel. I doubt that it was ever mentioned in the United States within the mainstream. Negotiations went on unofficially after Barack had called off the Taba negotiations. They continued with high-level participants from both sides, and they finally reached what are called the Geneva Accords, which were presented formally in Geneva in December 2003. There were senior delegations and strong messages of support from all of Europe and from other relevant actors. The New York Times had a dismissive report which said, the United States conspicuously was not among the governments sending a message of support. End of that story. There's further commentary. It's mostly worthless, and I'll skip it. Not worthless, however, is crucial evidence that escaped notice. For example, the assessment of Israeli intelligence during these years. Amos Malka, the head of Israeli military intelligence, summarized the consensus, I'm quoting him, The assumption was that Arafat prefers a diplomatic process, that he will do all he can to see it through, and that only when he comes to a dead end in the process will he turn to a path of violence. But this violence is aimed at getting him out of a dead end, to set international pressures in motion, and to get the extra mile. Western journalists could easily have discovered these assessments of Israeli intelligence from easily accessible sources, even in English, but they preferred the official history. We should hardly be surprised to discover that the three prime examples of U.S. British nobility, Lebanon, Iraq, and Israel, turn out to be very familiar. Europeans have a choice. They can choose to be passive observers of continuing crimes and victims of the terror that the crushing of the Palestinians is likely to inspire. Or they can take the lead in turning the Middle East into a region of peace and greater freedom of justice, a goal that is surely not beyond reach.